Was World War II truly the last just war? Were countries like Canada and the United States involved principally to protect human rights and democracy and liberate conquered nations from Nazi tyranny and Japanese aggression? How consistent were world leaders at the time in their opposition to Hitler? Was the critical turning point in the war attributable to the Allied invasion of Normandy or to much earlier battles on the Eastern Front? What role did U.S. industrial interests play in the conflict? What lessons should the people of Earth draw from that global nightmare as tensions increase in Ukraine, Syria, and elsewhere? On the occasion of the 70th anniversary of D-Day, the Global Research NewsHour takes a rare critical look at the motives and tactics of the Allied powers in the Second World War with guests Richard Saunders of the Coalition Opposed to the Arms Trade and historian and author Jacques Pauwels. On today's program, Rethinking World War II, Debunking the Myth of the Good War. Bringing you the analysis beyond the headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of June 6th, 2014. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM. We seek to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major stories shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. Our show is also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. We now know, partly from MP Moscal, that on the pivotal day of February 20th, which will remain the main focus of this report, sniper shots first hit police forces and came from buildings Parubuy controlled. Ukraine's previous head of the security service, SPU, Alexander Yakimenko, said so in March after fleeing to Russia. When the commandant proved unable to stop the sniping, which everyone claimed to be against Yakimenko, says he offered to send in a unit to help. He only needed a guarantee his men wouldn't be shot by Parubuy's, but he says that was denied. From all this, the SPU chief deduced the snipers were under Parubuy's command and protection. That's from the article, Who Was Maidan Sniper's Mastermind? By Adam Larson. Posted June 5th, originally published at Oriental Review. After the 9/11 attacks, Cheney tried to prevent an investigation. According to Keane and Hamilton's book, Without Precedent, each of the commissioners was also invited to have private meetings with Rumsfeld, who gave them advice throughout the investigation. This was despite the fact that Rumsfeld's DOD failed to provide many of the documents that had been requested. Considering the unraveling of the official accounts for 9/11, people don't need more deceptive comments from Richard Clark about the obvious post-9/11 crimes of Cheney and Rumsfeld. What people need to understand is that Cheney and Rumsfeld were running the show on 9/11 and were in perfect position to coordinate the attacks. That's from the article, War Crimes and 9/11, Why Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld Are Suspects, by Kevin Ryan, posted June 5th, originally appearing at Washington's blog. Considering the incredible growth in contracts that SAIC realized from the events of 9/11, any independent investigation into those events should carefully consider the role played by that company and its leadership. The company's role included creating the national databases that tracked and identified terrorists, supplying airport screening equipment, predicting and investigating terrorist attacks against WTC, helping to create the official account for what happened at the WTC after 9/11 and providing the information to capture KSM. Undoubtedly, SAIC's impact on the counterterrorism programs of the United States prior to 9/11 was unique and pervasive. Duane Andrews should be a person of specific interest because he had expert knowledge of the vulnerabilities of the U.S. defense and information systems at a time when many of those systems failed catastrophically. His history of being closely aligned with the activities of Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld for the 20 years prior to 9/11 provide additional reason to suspect him. That comes from the article, Profiting from 9/11, the Private Company That Played a Major Role in the War on Terror, by Kevin Ryan, posted June 5th, originally appearing in Dig Within. Ever since Nixon defaulted on the U.S. dollar's gold backing in 1971, the creation of this liquidity has zero restrictions whatsoever and is merely based on the whims and desires of the central planners-in-chief, i.e., the Federal Reserve. As the primary creator of the liquidity that every government on earth needs to survive, the Federal Reserve is thus the most powerful player globally in not only economic but also geopolitical affairs. The example of the so-called sovereign nation of Ecuador relinquishing its gold reserves to Goldman Sachs for liquidity, which can be conjured up by the Fed on a whim and at zero cost, tells you all you need to know about how the world works. This gold is headed straight to China or Russia. Good luck ever getting that back, amigos. That comes from the article, Ecuador to transfer more than half its gold reserves to Goldman Sachs in exchange for liquidity, by Michael Krieger, posted June 5th, originally published at Liberty Blitzkrieg. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu. June 6th marks the 70th anniversary of D-Day, the date in which Allied forces descended on the shores of Normandy to assist in the liberation of Western Europe from Nazi control and the restoration of the French Republic. It's been considered a major turning point in what has been called the Last Just War. Canada's role in the war has been frequently depicted as a noble and valiant sacrifice in support of freedom and democracy. How accurate is this appraisal of Canada's involvement in the war? We spoke recently with Richard Saunders, Ottawa-based coordinator of the Coalition Opposed to the Arms Trade and editor of Press for Conversion magazine. We spoke about little-known aspects of Canadian society at the time that seemed to contradict the narrative of Canada's role in the war as principally about upholder of freedom and democracy abroad. Maybe what we should do is maybe review the years leading up to the war, just to get a bit put in a bit of a context this role of Canada as sort of being devoted to human rights, dignity, and freedom from tyranny and persecution. What was happening, maybe say in the early part of that 30s decade, that might cause us to maybe question that commitment?
Oh yeah, we have a lot of reason to question that whole mythology about Canada, the great, wonderful, peaceable kingdom where we respect multinationalism or multiculturalism and human rights and democracy and peace and all those sorts of things. During the 1930s, the early 30s, of course, it was the Great Depression, and there were tens of thousands, some estimate 70,000, some more, homeless single men in Canadian cities. The Canadian government's response to this incredible problem of poverty among young single men, a lot of whom were working up to that point in remote camps, doing lumber camps, mining camps, and railroad construction camps, they were rounded up by the tens of thousands, kicked out of the cities and put on what basically were slave labor camps. They were forced into these camps. The government sold them as relief camps, you know, as if it was a way to help them. But according to documents that historians have looked at from the time, we know, for example, that the head of the Canadian military, McNaughton, Andrew McNaughton, in his report to explain why we needed these camps to Bennett, the Prime Minister, Conservative Prime Minister Bennett, McNaughton, the head of the army, said that these camps were required, were necessary, because these single unemployed men in the cities were a potential threat to civil society, to the social order in Canada, because they were potential Bolsheviks. They were potentially could be rounded up or used by communists to start a revolution in Canada. So they put about 170,000 men into these slave labor camps in Canada, 150 of these remote camps. So they were rounded up, taken out of the cities, put into these remote camps where they worked for about 20 cents a day, which was a tenth of the laborers' salary at the time. And they had terrible conditions. They weren't allowed to organize, but they did. And they organized unions on these camps. Communists actually worked to help them to organize labor unions, and they went on strike, and there were hundreds of strikes. And these camps, which existed between 1932 and 1936. But in 1935, thousands of these homeless single men basically came out of the camps and organized occupations of government buildings in Vancouver, for example, and then they decided to take their protest to Ottawa. It was called the On to Ottawa Trek, and Prime Minister Bennett was really freaked out by this because he didn't want to have what they were suspecting were going to be 20,000 by the time it got to Ottawa. The movement was expected to grow to 20 or 40,000 homeless people coming to Ottawa, so they stopped them in Regina, and the RCMP attacked the crowd with baseball bats on horse, and they were on horseback, and they shot into the crowd, and it was incredible example of repression in Canadian history, and the suppression of movement that was, its demands included things like a 5-day work week, 7-hour work day, and unemployment insurance. These are really radical concepts that obviously we need to round them up, smash their heads in, and put them in jail, and keep them in these relief camps, so-called, in order to prevent this sort of horrible radicalism from spreading in Canada. So that's the kind of thing that was happening in the 30s. They were also deporting a lot of people, especially foreigners. So the Canadian government deported about 15,000 people between 1930 and 1933, so about 5,000 people per year. Between 1900 and 1930, about 25,000 people were deported, and a lot of them were deported because they were considered to be radicals, to be communists or anarchists or labor activists, and this was a way of getting rid of them and sending them back mostly to Southern Europe or Eastern Europe, where they had come from sometimes many years before. Previously.
I feel that there are some eerie parallels there between, you know, whether taking people and putting them on camps or, you know, deporting them and what was happening in Hitler's Germany.
Hitler did the same thing. He rounded up the first camps that Hitler created were, of course, for, they executed disabled people. But the first camps were really for communists and anarchists and labor activists, and they rounded them up. And that their camp started, I think, in 1932, so or 33 maybe. I think Dachau was initiated in 1933, so it was around the same time. I think Canada was even a little bit earlier. We had internment camps, but we initially called them concentration camps during the First World War. Of course, we had the reservations, which were a kind of way of rounding people up and forcing them to stay within restricted areas. If Native people were found off of the reserves, they could be jailed if they didn't have the proper paperwork. But in, during World War One, Canada had tens of thousands of people in these what we called then concentration camps. And they were scattered in remote areas all across Canada. Many of them were used later in the 30s as the relief camps. The same, they were the same physical camps. But in World War One, even after World War One ended, this is an interesting thing. After World War One ended, many of these concentration camps in Canada were kept going. So for a year and a half after the war ended, and that these camps, remember, were ostensibly for keeping prisoners of war or people who might be supportive of the enemy during the war. Even after the war ended, they kept these camps going. And why did they keep them going? Was because they were fearful that these guys in the camps were Bolsheviks, that they were communists, that they were going to support a revolution in Canada. So we kept them in concentration camps because of the, you know, I mean, there was the revolution in Soviet Russia. And Canada also sent thousands of troops, I believe about 4,200 troops, to fight in the Civil War that happened after the Soviet Revolution in 1919. There were 14 countries that invaded Soviet Russia to try to contain or stop that spread of that, of the evil red menace.
People are, I think, are well aware of at this point is that there was the internment of Japanese Canadians because there was that concern, as well as that the Jews who were escaping persecution would be turned away from the country.
Canada was not allowing any Jews into Canada. So, for instance, when there was this boatload of Jewish refugees, 900 of them, trying to get into Canada, Mackenzie King's liberal government welcomed their steamship with a gunboat. We actually sent a gunboat out to stop them. And many people now know about that and know about how repressive our government was towards Jews and not allowing them into the country even when they were trying to escape from. This was that boatload that was turned away with 900 Jewish refugees. That was in 1939, June of 1939. So many people now know about that, but what we don't know, or many people in Canada don't know, is that Britain basically had accepted thousands of refugees from Europe that were fleeing from fascism in Europe, and they were put into internment camps in Britain. They were Britain needed to get rid of them, and so it told Canada and Australia that it was going to send them prisoners of war. But when they got here, the Canadian government realized that they were mostly refugees from Europe that were fleeing from fascism. They were not prisoners of war. Many of them were Jewish, but they were also other kinds of refugees fleeing from fascism. So the Canadian government was really upset because we didn't want any Jews. And the Canadian public and the churches were on board with that ideology of not wanting Jews in Canada. And this is, an appalling part of our history, but it needs to be recognized. And so what we did was Canada put them into internment camps. So in May 1940, there were 2,300 prisoners arrived. Many of them were, or most of them were actually refugees fleeing from Nazi repression. And it wasn't until July 1941 that an order in council came saying that these Jewish prisoners in Canada could be treated as refugees. Then they were given some additional privileges, but they were kept in the internment camps. So they became refugee camps, but they were internment camps. They were still held behind barbed wire, and they still had they were living under poor conditions. They weren't allowed to leave these internment camps in Canada. There were nine of them in Canada, in New Brunswick, Ontario, and Quebec. There were five of them in Quebec. And just give you a little quote here. There was one in northern Ontario, Camp R. And 85% of the people in this camp were Nazis. But mixed into the Nazis were these Jewish refugees. And one of the Jewish refugees described later, he said, "Vigilant soldiers with rifles and fixed bayonets were ready to charge us at any moment." That's how he described when they arrived at the camp. So between 1940 and 1943, most of the prisoners that came from Britain, that Britain was getting rid of, were civilian refugees. And many of them were also communist sympathizers. And authorities in 1941, talking about Camp Farnham in Quebec, just east of Montreal, he reported, a prison guard reported, close to 45% of the inmates were communist sympathizers. So that explains why they were kept behind bars, even though the Soviet Union was on board, and they were the main force against the Nazis, and 25 million Soviets were killed during the war. You know, Canada was putting Jews and communists, who were the enemies of the Nazis, we were putting them behind barbed wire in internment camps in Canada.
Well, Richard, clearly, all of that suggests that Canadian elite opinion didn't oppose Hitler on the basis of his racist policies.
Oh, absolutely not.
But what about the general public? I mean, they went along with all of this as well. I mean, was there a sort of a similar kind of mass psychosis or whatever you want to call it that affected the same same sort of thing that affected the German population, that the population of the general population of Canada would go along with those sorts of initiatives while fighting this war in Germany?
Yeah, that's a good point, and I appreciate your use of the word mass psychosis. It really was a mass psychosis, and it was fed by propaganda, of course, from the elite in Canada. There was incredible fear, hatred, xenophobia against foreigners. There was racism was rampant in Canada, and it went throughout the Canadian society. Of course, not everyone was a racist, but it was certainly a predominant ideology. The ethnocentrism and the xenophobia were rampant in Canada. And about the elite, to move away from the general public, I could mention, though, that the churches were very, for the most part, unsympathetic towards the Jewish refugees and the fact that they were being imprisoned in Canadian internment camps during the war, that the Catholic Church and the Protestant churches were silent or worse. And there was not a widespread public support for helping Jewish people and for getting them out of those concentration camps that we had here in Canada. But I want to mention about the elites in Canada. For example, Mackenzie King went and met with Hitler and some other top Nazi leaders in 1937. He was in England for a big imperial conference, and he went and he met first with Hitler's right-hand man, General Hermann Göring, who was the founder of the Gestapo, and he was the commander-in-chief of the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force. And King met with Göring, and here's what he said. King said he never, quote, never knew the attitude toward, this is what King told Göring, that he had never known the attitude towards Germany to be as friendly as it was, unquote. He was talking about London's Imperial Conference. So London's Imperial Conference in 1937, just a couple years before the war started, was very sympathetic to the Nazis. Now, King also met with the Nazi foreign minister, Neurath, who was an SS group leader, and he was the equivalent of a major general. And King recorded in his diary that Neurath admitted that they had taken some pretty rough steps in cleaning up the Jewish situation. He said, "I would have loathed living in Berlin with the Jews. Many of them were very coarse and vulgar and assertive. I left him feeling that I had met a man whose confidence I would continue to enjoy through the rest of my days. He is, if there ever was one, a genuinely kind, good man." This is King talking about Neurath, an SS group leader. Okay, so then Hitler also, King also met with Hitler, and King wrote that Hitler smiled very pleasantly and indeed had a sort of appealing and affectionate look in his eyes. And then he says that Hitler, quote, "is really one who truly loves his fellow man." And then King describes Hitler as a calm, passive man, deeply and thoughtfully in earnest. And then King says about Hitler, "His eyes impressed me most of all. There was a liquid quality about them which indicates keen perception and profound sympathy. Calm, composed, and one could see how particularly humble folk would have come to have profound love for the man. As I talked with him, I could not but think of Joan of Arc." So this is our Prime Minister talking about Hitler. So obviously the sympathy, and Mackenzie King, of course, is well known to have been extremely anti-Semitic. The Canadian policies of no Jews are too many could not have existed in the bureaucracy if it hadn't been for support from the leaders like King. But that's the thing. Canadian attitudes about our country are just filled with a kind of a mythology. There's a narrative that tells us that Canada is this great, wonderful, human rights loving, peace promoting, multicultural loving country. But our history begs to tell us something quite different. And Canadians really need to, and would find very interesting, knowing more about our history, because it's really incredible.
Well, Richard Saunders, I think we're probably going to have to close it right there. But I want to thank you very much, because you've included a lot of what would come as very inconvenient truths for those of us who've come to see World War II and Canada's involvement in that war as part of a grand, noble, and valiant operation. So thanks so much for sharing that with us.
Well, thanks, Michael. And, of course, killing tens of millions of people is never a wonderful, grand, human rights-promoting endeavor. People nowadays who want to promote this or that U.S. or NATO-led war and harken back to the great Second World War really should learn a little bit more about their history and learn about how the United States and Canada and the other imperialist countries are not waging these wars over the centuries because they promote human rights. Wars are not fought to promote human rights. They're fought to make vast profits, trillions of dollars, for a small number of people, corporate elites. And that's the real reason behind all wars. It's to make money for a small number of people. But they have to pretend that they're about human rights and pretend that they're about peace and justice and humanitarian issues. But they're not. They never were, and they never will be. So people have to learn about the pretexts that are used for wars. And it's disgusting how the Canadian government is using the Second World War to promote its ongoing interests in fighting wars for corporate profit.
Richard Saunders, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Richard Saunders is the coordinator of the Ottawa-based network Coalition Opposed to the Arms Trade. You can reach access his website at coat.ncf.ca. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg, campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM, and on the Progressive Radio Network at GTRN.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. World War II was a major historical event that shaped the geopolitical landscape to this day. While even mainstream accounts are willing to acknowledge the atrocities committed by both sides in war, the general narrative persists that the war was worth fighting and that support for the Allied powers was necessary in order to stop a far worse adversary in Germany and Japan. How accurate is this assessment of the war, and what other myths do we have about that war that need breaking? To discuss this and related topics, we're joined by Dr. Jacques Pauwels. Dr. Pauwels is a Belgian-born Canadian historian who has authored numerous articles and books on the topic of World War II. His 2000 book, The Myth of the Good War, America in the Second World War, spent 4 months on the nonfiction bestseller lists in Europe. He joins us now from Santiago de Compostela. Well, nice to talk with you, Dr. Pauwels. Thank you for joining us.
Pleasure being here.
You may mention in the book that Western or U.S. industrialists, particularly people like the grandfather of President George W. Bush, Prescott Bush, and industrials Henry Ford and others, were backers of Hitler's regime in the lead up to the war. To what extent was their support necessary in order for Hitler to have actually begun to wage the war in the first place?
Well, the reality is that many of the big industrialists, not only in the United States, but also in Britain and elsewhere, kind of liked Hitler because of what he stood for. He stood for basically repressing unions and socialist and communist parties, and for giving basically big corporations, you could call it capitalists, a big break in terms of providing cheap labor and so on. So they liked that about him. And they also liked very much the fact that since he was arming to preparing for war, that he was willing to buy from them the kind of equipment which they happened to produce, and by the sale of which they could make a lot of money. And this is one of the big issues. Before the war started in the 30s, Hitler needed all kinds of equipment, tanks, trucks, engines, planes, and above all, lots of raw materials like rubber and oil, which he could not find in Germany, he had to buy elsewhere. And the reality is that he bought all of that from American sources, not only American sources, but primarily American sources, from American corporations like, indeed, General Motors and Ford and so on, and Standard Oil of New Jersey, the Rockefeller family, Exxon, today Exxon, and that these companies made a lot of money in the process. And if you have a good customer that allows you to do wonderful business and allows you to make a lot of money, chances are you're going to like that customer. So in the 30s, Hitler was a very good customer of big American corporations, and the leaders and managers of American corporations, the owners and managers, liked Hitler a lot because of that. And the fact that he was preparing for war did not bother them, because everybody could see what was coming, what kind of war was coming. Hitler was preparing for a war against the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union was the homeland of communism. And communists were what you hated if you were an American industrialist like Henry Ford. You hated the only communists in Russia, but you hated also the communists and Reds in general in your own country. And the idea that Hitler would unleash a war and wipe out the Soviet Union, that was something that was a wonderful thought. So here's a double whammy. You have a guy that is, first of all, a customer of yours. He buys from you all kinds of things. He pays the bills. You know, you make big profits. And he's going to use the weapons that you sell him to wipe out the Soviet Union, a country you hate. So, hey, you can't lose. This was a wonderful thing. That's why a lot of people in the 30s had nothing bad to say about Hitler. They liked Hitler a lot.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, just sort of, you know, going further, that the whole threat coming from communism, was there concerns on the home front that somehow the ideas of communism might somehow spread to the United States, like following the Great Depression?
Well, there was a great concern about that. Today, it's kind of hard to imagine that, and many of us like to think that in the United States, there was never a socialist or communist movement of any importance, but that's actually totally wrong. After the First World War, when the Russian Revolution broke out and Lenin and the Bolsheviks established a new state, the Soviet Union, that caused a lot of enthusiasm among people, not only in Europe, but also in the United States. There were a lot of so-called Reds, and as a result of that, people who did not like the idea, you know, were very concerned about the presence and the activities of the so-called Reds in their own country, and were looking for ways to wipe them out, actually. What made it worse was that in the 1930s, when the Great Depression started and huge economic problems emerged, unemployment and widespread poverty and so on, a lot of people thought that this was actually the beginning of the end for capitalism. And he thought that socialism, even Soviet-style socialism, was the way for the future. And that was a great cause of concern for industrialists like Henry Ford and Rockefellers and so forth. And they saw the Soviet Union as the source, you might say, the source of inspiration, the guiding light of the Reds in your own country. So if somebody like Hitler would be willing to do that dirty job and wipe out the Soviet Union, that would be great, because that would then, hopefully, from their perspective, also put an end to this kind of Red movement in your own country.
Could you talk about, for these industrialists, how profitable was it to support the Nazis that in the mid to late 30s?
It was extremely profitable and extremely important, because the 30s were, historians in the United States call the 30s the dirty 30s, meaning that things were going bad in general. I mean, the economy was bad. It was the Great Depression. I mean, there was lots of unemployment. There were strikes. There were social problems. There was widespread poverty. You know, and indeed, a lot of people started to believe that it would be the end of capitalism. But whether it would be the end of capitalism or not, even for capitalists, it was a bad time. Profits were not very high because essentially people didn't have any purchasing power, being as poor as they were. So Henry Ford, for example, couldn't sell his cars, which he could mass produce easily, but he couldn't sell them. But in Hitler, basically Germany went through the Great Depression also. But Hitler solved the problem by stimulating demand by basically preparing for war. So Hitler wanted to buy cars and want to buy planes and engines and tanks and so on. And the reality is that he was willing to buy them from Ford and General Motors and so on, who, by the way, had major, major plants in Germany and who were willing and keen to supply Hitler with those goods. And they did. And Hitler did order not little cars for the Germans, but trucks and tanks and airplanes, which were assembled in the plants of General Motors, for example, such as the big Opel plant in Rüsselsheim near Frankfurt. And the huge plant, which Ford had established in Cologne on the banks of the Rhine in 1929, the so-called Fordwerke, a huge plant which is still there today in Cologne. And via these branch plants in Germany, Ford and General Motors and other big American corporations sold a lot of equipment to the Nazis and made a lot of money. So actually, they were making more money by selling goods to the Nazis than they were making doing that at home. So that's why they really liked Hitler, because you could almost argue that without the business generated by the Nazi regime, that some of these companies might well have gone under, because at home the business was not good at all. It was in fact very bad. So you might say that you could argue that a lot of the profits made by Ford and General Motors in the 30s come from Germany.
Now, in mainstream accounts, we frequently hear, especially when we're in the lead up to a major war or conflict, we keep hearing that not only do we have to stop the next Hitler, but we can't be an appeaser like Chamberlain. Could you talk a little bit about popular misunderstandings of the appeasement policy with regard to Hitler and the Sudetenlands?
Well, the appeasement policy, of which Chamberlain, the British Prime Minister, was the main architect, but which was actually also agreed to by the French, obviously, who were the main allies of the British, and even of the Roosevelt government. The appeasement policy is interpreted usually as a sign of weakness of the Western powers. Presumably Chamberlain, you know, was afraid of war with Hitler and therefore made concessions to Hitler and out of weakness, so to speak, hoping that somehow by making concessions he would, you know, appease Hitler and thereby prevent war. And we know that didn't happen. And that misconception, because that's what it is, that misconception is cited sometimes to say, well, we cannot be nice guys when dictators do nasty things and make demands. We have to immediately, you know, sort of put a stop to that and be prepared to fight. You know, I guess Bush used that kind of argument to wage war against Saddam Hussein. Similar arguments were used elsewhere also. But the reality is that that's not what appeasement was all about. Chamberlain was not really particularly scared of Germany, certainly with France as an ally, which had a big army, and Britain with its still powerful navy. The two of them could have handled, you know, could have handled Germany. Certainly the United States would have come to the rescue as well. And the real purpose, the real rationale, the real function of the appeasement policy was to encourage Hitler to fight his war against the Soviet Union, which, as I just explained, was in the interest of big corporations in not only the United States, but also in Britain and in France. Ever since the Russian Revolution occurred in 1917, which horrified London and Paris and Washington as well, there was a desire to snuff out that revolution. And it was originally tried by means of Allied intervention in Russia, even as the First World War was not even finished yet. Even in the summer of 1918, the British sent troops to Russia to fight the Bolsheviks, to fight with the whites against the Reds. But that intervention did not work for a number of reasons. We had to give it up. And as a result of that, the Reds won the Civil War and the Soviet Union was established. But the hope remained alive in places like London and Paris, and indeed in Washington, that someday, you know, we could finish that job and put an end to the revolution in Russia, which was a bad example because it actually encouraged our own Reds. And the question was, who was going to do it? Well, in the 30s, Hitler seemed the right guy to do the job. And it wasn't that wonderful because, first of all, Germany was strong enough to do the job, wiping out the Soviet Union. And secondly, if he would do it, we wouldn't have to do it. So it was a wonderful thing. And then Hitler, in preparing for that war, would buy equipment for us, so we made money on it. So you can see how in the 30s, the whole idea in the West, in the so-called Western world, was not to fight Hitler or to even make concessions to him to avoid having him attack us. The idea was to encourage him quietly, without saying so, because you could not tell your public that this was what you had in mind, but encouraging Hitler to attack the Soviet Union. Practical problem was there was a couple of little countries in between, like Czechoslovakia, for example, and Poland, and that if Hitler was going to attack the Soviet Union, you had to basically give him those countries. And this is what happened, for example, the Treaty of Munich in 1938, when the Allies essentially sacrificed Czechoslovakia and gave it to Hitler on a silver platter so that he could actually move through there on his way to the Soviet Union. So the appeasement was not what it appears to be.
The Soviets were, in fact, the main adversary of the Nazis, and it interestingly enough that they would form a non-aggression pact with the Soviets. In terms of the Soviets' role in the overall war, it was a very significant factor, was it not?
Well, it was, and there's a number of things that should be clarified, a number of things that most people are not aware of. I mean, most people are vaguely aware of the Hitler-Stalin Pact, and very often it's presented as a prelude to the war. In fact, many historians present that as the beginning of the war, as if there were an alliance between Moscow and Berlin that started the war, but it wasn't really like that at all. What happened was that Stalin was prepared to make a pact with Hitler only after he had been turned down in attempts to make an agreement with London and Paris and everybody else against Hitler. But he was ignored for the same reason I just mentioned, that London and Paris were not interested in a deal with Moscow against Berlin. They were much more interested in encouraging Berlin to attack the Soviet Union. So when Stalin in the 30s, in 35, 36, 37, made overtures to London and Paris to make an alliance against Germany, against Hitler Germany, he was rebuffed. And instead, the Allies basically encouraged Hitler. Now, Stalin understood very well what was going on. He understood very well at that stage that the Allies were determined to have Hitler attack him and help him to do so. And as a result of that, he was looking for ways to defend. There was no illusion on the part of Hitler that he would be friends now with Stalin. He still hated Stalin. His ultimate aim still remained to attack the Soviet Union. But Hitler had felt that he couldn't trust London and Paris, and that, you know, before he could attack the Soviet Union, he needed to protect his back. And he had to deal with the West first and eliminate that threat so that then he could turn all his attention to the Soviet Union. This is exactly what he did. In 1939, 1940, essentially, he defeated France and thought he neutralized Britain. And then that he thought, now enabled him to focus all his attention on the Soviet Union, on what he felt the big mission of his life, wiping out the Soviet Union. And as soon as possible, he'd move to do exactly that in June 1941. But to come back to the second point about the Russians, one should say the Soviets, not the Russians. It's fair to say that Germany, to defeat Germany, was a major job because Nazi Germany was a huge, powerful monster. It had to be defeated by a coalition whereby everybody had to make a contribution. And I certainly recognize the contribution that everybody made. I believe the Americans made an important contribution. The Canadians did. The British did. We needed everybody's help. But there's no denying that the Soviets made by far the biggest contribution. And that's sadly what's forgotten on a day like today, when we celebrate with lots of oompa-pa and lots of fanfare the landings in Normandy. But the reality is the landings in Normandy, important as they were not nearly as important as the big battles fought on the Eastern Front, like the battle in Moscow in December 41 already, the real turning point of the war, as I argue in an article that's found on that you can find on the Internet. And then the Battle of Stalingrad, which was a huge battle, you know, involving hundreds of thousands of men, where Germany lost something like 300,000 men, and that was a catastrophic blow. Now, that was finished in early 43, a year and a half before the Allies could land in Normandy. It's almost fair to say that the Allies, in a way, didn't have to land troops anymore in Normandy, because it was long decided, it was long known that Germany would lose the war. Even if, to put it this way, even if the Allies had not landed in Normandy, Hitler would have lost the war. The difference would have been that the Soviet Union would have won the war single-handedly. They would have occupied all of Germany, and they would have continued to liberate the Low Countries and France and everything. And that's what in London and in Washington didn't want to happen. So in a sense, our troops landed in Normandy, not so much to liberate France, but to prevent the Soviets from liberating it. Because that would have been a catastrophe. It would have been the opposite result of what we had hoped for in 1939, namely that Hitler would wipe out the Soviet Union. In a sense, that would have the result would have been the opposite. It would have been the end of Germany as a power, and basically ascendancy, Soviet ascendancy over all of Europe, all the way to the Atlantic. And that would have been a catastrophe from the perspective of of Washington and of London, and that's why we landed in Normandy.
That brings to mind the other major player in the war, and that was the Japan. That was the bombing of Pearl Harbor was what ostensibly brought the United States actively involved in the war. After Pearl Harbor, Germany declared war on the United States. And so the United States became very much involved with that war in Europe as well as in the Pacific. So do you want to talk a little bit about the U.S. motivations with regard to Japan and, you know, what clearly, I mean, other than the fact that there was that, you know, the war being declared and the Japanese assault, were there motivations there for the United States to?
Well, the United States, from the 30s already, you know, saw Japan as a very dangerous rival, and vice versa. Actually, in Washington in the 30s, they did not so much object to Hitler's ambitions on behalf of Germany. In fact, if anything, they encouraged Hitler's ambitions. Hitler's ambitions were seen to be directed towards the East anyways, wiping out the Soviet Union. So what's wrong with that? From the perspective of Washington, that was just fine. And that Hitler, in the process, might even, you know, grab some more territories in Europe did not seem to be a big problem. The more so since the American companies that were active in Germany were expecting to benefit from any German expansion in Europe. So in the 1930s, prior to 1939, in fact, prior to Pearl Harbor, you might say, in the United States, the government, which has the interests of the major American corporations in mind, and very little else, actually, you could argue, you know, didn't see a problem much with German imperialism, to use that term, but they saw a big problem with Japanese imperialism, because Japanese imperialism was a big competitor in an area which the Americans had their eye on for quite some time, namely the Far East, especially China. China was the big country, the big prize, actually. Even in the First World War already, the idea was that some of the great powers, Britain, Japan, the United States, would basically be able to not so much colonize China, that was perhaps asking a bit much, but penetrate China economically, you know, get the contracts to build railways, you know, get all kinds of privileges and concessions, as they call them, you know. And the question was who would be in there to take advantage of the opportunities that were expected to arise in China. And in the First World War, Japan actually entered the war for the sole reason, the sole purpose of being able to make claims in China, which they did. And the United States also then was in there and was very keen to make sure that Japan wouldn't monopolize the business in China. Now, the issue, the rivalry between Japan and the United States over China and surrounding areas, Korea, you know, Vietnam and all that, even though some of these places were still European colonies, that did not get settled during or after the First World War. But in the 30s, that antagonism, that rivalry, was coming to a head. And it was quite clear that, at least to some people in the States and some people in Japan, figured that the only way this problem could be settled was through war. And indeed, the United States had major plans ready for war against Japan in the 30s, but, for example, no plans for war against Germany. That reflects what I just said, that from the perspective of the United States, German imperialism was not a problem, therefore we make no plans for war against them. Japanese imperialism was a problem, and therefore we made plans for war against them. So it was probably only a matter of time before those two countries would come to go to war. Now, Roosevelt, there's still a lot of discussion about that, and some things are certainly not clear. But it would appear that Roosevelt was in favor of a war against Japan. But Roosevelt also knew that he could not sell that war to the American public, that the American public would not take lightly to Roosevelt somehow starting a war. So he wanted to be seen to be defending, to be reacting to a Japanese aggression. And that is how we came to Pearl Harbor. Pearl Harbor was an attack by the Japanese, which was in some ways provoked, and it's almost certain now that in Washington knew it was coming and deliberately did nothing to prevent it because they wanted to be attacked so they could have the war we wanted while being seen to be simply defending ourselves. Now, it's not a coincidence that the big ships that were really important sailed away quietly from Pearl Harbor a few days before the attack, and what the Japanese actually sank was some old clunkers of the First World War. Yeah, with all due respect, I mean, the Pearl Harbor was a spectacular attack, but it did not do all that much damage to the Americans. What did damage, though, what did spoil the plans, if that's what it was, the plans for war against Japan, was another unforeseen factor, namely that the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor would drag the United States into war with Germany, as was not expected, because at that time, December 1941, the United States was not at war with Germany. It was actually neutral. And in fact, until that time, American companies in Germany were making lots of money producing for Hitler. I mean, a lot of the oil, a lot of the fuel that the German tanks used, you know, to drive all the way to Moscow, sorry, to first to Warsaw and then to Brussels and to Paris and later on to the outskirts of Moscow, that was bought from sources like Texaco and Exxon and so on, well, Standard Oil, and the Americans made all the money in the process. So really, they had no plan for war against Germany. But oddly enough, after the attack of the Japanese on Pearl Harbor, after Congress was asked by Roosevelt to declare war on Japan, Germany declared war on the United States, which was unexpected, because many people think, totally wrongly, that the United States declared a war on Germany after Pearl Harbor together while declaring war against Japan, but it did not, because Germany had nothing whatsoever to do with Pearl Harbor. Hitler didn't even know about the Japanese plans to attack Pearl Harbor. And when the Americans the next day declared war on Japan, essentially, they could have stayed out of the war in Europe. There could have been two wars, one between the United States and Japan in the Pacific and East Asia, and another one which was raging in Europe between Britain and the Soviet Union against Germany. But it was Hitler who unexpectedly, as far as Washington was concerned, unexpectedly as far as Roosevelt was concerned, declared war on the United States 4 days after Pearl Harbor on the 11th of December 1941. And the reasons he did that, actually, well, if you have time to talk about it, I can talk about it, but that was a bit of a surprise. And that meant then that the United States had to fight a war not only against Japan, but also against Germany. And that is how, actually, according to one American historian, Stephen Ambrose, the United States sort of backed into the war against Germany, did not really enter the war against Germany. So the idea that the United States went to war because they hated Hitler's dictatorship and his racism and his anti-Semitism and all that is simply not true, because they didn't want to declare war on him. They didn't intend to declare war on him. he declared war on them unexpectedly, which raises the question, what would have happened if Hitler had not declared war on the United States? The question, it's fair to ask, would the United States ever have declared war on Germany? Maybe not.
You know, I'm afraid we're almost out of time, but I was wondering if you might have a quick comment about lessons learned from that war and the current geopolitical realities, if there's something we should keep in mind as we look at, for example, the current growing confrontation between NATO and Soviet Union.
There's a lot of lessons to be learned from looking at history. And one is that the United States economy in the 1930s, in the United States itself, was in bad shape. It was the Great Depression. And many people, even many Americans, thought it was the end of capitalism. And therefore, they were preparing and ready to embrace a socialist future, possibly based on the Soviet model, which would scare the hell out of American corporate leaders like Ford and so on. And the reason why the United States pulled itself out of the Depression is two reasons for it. One is, one factor which really helped the cause was the advent of fascist systems like that of Hitler, which prepared for war and bought their products in the United States. So what we can say is that war became the dynamo of the American economy. It was the preparations for war by Hitler, for example, that meant wonderful business for corporations in the States. And then when the war started, the United States could also start selling goods, and I say selling, not giving, as some people think, to the Brits at very high prices, lend-lease, very high prices, not given, as people think, similarly the Marshall Plan, no free gifts, just simply credits, loans, at high interest rates. That meant that war was fantastic for business. And this is the sad thing. This is still important today. I'll repeat it. War was fantastic for business. War saved the American economy. You know, because of the war, the Second World War, the American economy pulled out of the Great Depression. So when no sooner did the war end, then a new war started. We call it the Cold War. And after the Cold War, the Gulf War. And after the Gulf War, the war against terrorism. And I would argue, and I'm not the only one, that these wars are needed to keep the American economy going. You know, these wars are good for business, so to speak. I mean, they're not good for Americans, they're not good for people, but they're good for business. They're good for the profit lines. That's what it is. And in fact, you could argue that if true peace would ever break out on Earth, it would be a catastrophe for the American economy. Because without the orders from the Pentagon, and without the orders generated by the spread of NATO, where even little countries like Estonia and soon Ukraine, we have to buy their weapons, all kinds of planes and tanks from the Americans, which is part of being part of NATO, you know. I mean, without that, you know, the American economy would not be able to produce and to make profits, because the small business of the economy, producing televisions and cars and so on, that's all been taken over by the Japanese and the Chinese and anybody else. What especially of the American economy today is hard military hardware, and of course, and like aircraft and so on, and you could say tanks and so forth. So war is good for the economy. War is actually, you could say that the American economy is now hooked on war. Can't live without war anymore. So that's a big lesson to learn.
Okay, we've got to leave it there, but I want to thank you very much for being our guest on this special D-Day anniversary edition of the Global Research News Hour.
My pleasure.
Dr. Jacques Pauwels is a Belgian-born Canadian historian who is the author of the book The Myth of the Good War, America in the Second World War. He's also a frequent contributor to the Global Research website. That concludes our show. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our program every week on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on partner radio stations across the country. The show can be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm and can be downloaded from the website globalresearch.ca. Thank you for joining us. If you have any questions or comments about today's program, feel free to send your feedback to globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Join us again next week.